This week's podcast is brought to you by Alluring Africa, which is a Florida-based boutique African tour operator founded by my friend Sunit Sangrachka. Sunit was born and raised in Africa, growing up in a family that started one of the first photographic companies in Kenya. Sunit and his team specialize in conservation-based safaris to Africa's exclusive wilderness areas that support its wildlife and communities. Alluring Africa goes beyond the prepackaged itineraries you see online because they understand the only way to organize the best experience for you is to have an intimate understanding of what you care about. Give them a call on 800-510-6059 or go to their website www.alluringafrica.com, and that's spelled A-L-L-U-R-I-N-G-A-F-R-I-C-A. Thanks for tuning into the Greenpeace. That's spelt P-I-E-C-E. I'm Warren Green, your host and one of the storytellers of this weekly podcast, where I'll be telling campfire stories about sustainable safaris, misadventures, and travel tales from around the world. I have a number of interesting people, including safari guides, conservationists, lodge managers, and philanthropists lined up to share their stories and expertise with you. So, grab yourself a beverage, sink back into a comfortable chair, and enjoy the next half an hour with me. I'm really excited to chat to you because, I don't know, when did I start following you on Instagram? Maybe 2 years ago, which would probably have been when you decided to climb Pikes Peak, or is that the Manitou Ridge that you did first?
I first did the Manitou Incline on April 22nd of 2018. And I went on to do Pikes Peak and started that expedition on June 10th of 2018 and ended on June 13th.
Okay, yeah. So then it was about 2 years ago that I got inspired by your story. And I'm deliberately not leading in with what your story is because I want that to evolve. And right now, I may as well just let my listeners out there know that I'm speaking to Mandy Horvath, and that's spelt H-O-R-V-A-T-H. She goes by Life Proof Bionic Woman on Instagram. And you can find her on Facebook as Mandy Horvath. And that's a public page. I've decided to talk to her today, and it's a bit of a departure from my comfort zone because, I mean, Mandy, you'll appreciate this if you've investigated my background. I'm a conservationist. I'm all about sustainable practices and talking to people who've done some really remarkable things in sustaining our planet. And so talking to you is a little bit of a departure from the subject matter that I'm mostly comfortable with. But I really wanted to have your story told at a time when we in the travel industry are, I suppose, truthfully dying. Coronavirus, COVID-19, and I deliberately haven't led in any of my podcasts with reference to this because I've always wanted to be positive, inspirational, and talk about things that are uplifting rather than sort of staying focused on this perpetual COVID disease that we see every single day. But our industry has been decimated. Across Africa, where I've most of my representation work, there are thousands of people that have lost their jobs, they've been furloughed. They are literally struggling living a hand-to-mouth existence off plots of land where they grow their own kitchen crops and so on. And so the travel industry marketplace is a very depressed place with a lot of people feeling like they've hit the lowest point of their lives without jobs. And for them, there's no light at the end of the tunnel just yet. And I kind of feel after I know your story and knowing your story makes me feel, well, big deal, guys. You know, I think you can appreciate how, I suppose, insignificant your issues really, really are when you hear of somebody else's. So let me start off by reading something that I read on a website, and it goes something like this. It's a long, hard 13.5-mile climb uphill with a gain of about 7,400 feet in elevation. Basically, it's a half marathon in hiking form. Please only attempt hiking Pikes Peak if you are healthy, able to hike long distances, able to navigate difficult terrain, and able to perform high cardio activity at low oxygen. So that's a very serious warning to anybody attempting to hike up Pikes Peak, which is one of America's 14ers. And for those back in Africa who don't know what a 14er is, these are some of the highest peaks in North America. There are 58 of them in Colorado. And there are about six or so that are most accessible from the Denver area. Pikes Peak is one of those. So it is quite popular as a destination. However, it's challenging. Now, Mandy here happens to have hiked up Pikes Peak. Tell me about your training before you got to climb that mountain.
To be quite honest with you, I didn't train at all. I full-heartedly believe, and a lot of people told me that I was crazy prior to doing this, because I had just decided to do it. But one of my, go-to sayings is to trust your mind. Your mind can carry you. Your body can do amazing, incredible things. You just have to make sure that your mental strength is up to par.
And I think that's a mantra that many athletes live by. And so that warning that's put out on the website about, you know, make sure that you're in physical condition to do this hike shouldn't be taken lightly. And yet there you go, right? You decide just one day you're going to get to the top of this mountain. But that was only after you'd already sort of figured out you could do the Manitou Ridge first, or the Manitou Incline, right?
Yes, sir. I'm a little bit of a different situation. And so back in 2014, I was struck by a locomotive and my limbs were severed from my body. In that incident, I died three times and told I was never going to walk again.
Will you stop there for a second? Because you kind of jumped the gun. You said you died three times.
Yes, sir.
Now, I've always been curious, and I'm going to be asking you some questions, which I hope you don't mind asking. If they're uncomfortable, then you just pause me and we'll move right along. But what does it feel like to die?
It's peaceful.
Yeah.
It's indescribable. The one experience that I was actually conscious for going into, it was very strange because there was people screaming outside of the ambulance. There was a man standing above me slapping my face, and the vision had just tunneled. And the only thing that I remember hearing before going out was "not yet, my child." And that could have been the man above me that was trying to keep me there with him. It could have been anything. But it was peaceful, unfortunately.
And so you did that happened three times, I suppose. I guess after being run over by a train, you suffer a lot of blood loss. Your body just expires, right? Or was it in?
I was in a massive amount of shock. I didn't even know that I had lost my legs. Laying there on the gurney, and there was a white light above my head, and I had just come into consciousness, and a man was slapping my face as hard as he could and asking me to stay with him. And I remember saying to him, I want to go home. Where am I at? I'm fine. And at that point, I had tried to sit up, and he pushed me back down on the gurney and started putting a cervical collar on me. And he had let me know, ma'am, I'm going to need you to calm down. You've just lost your legs. And me being me, I'm quite a bit stubborn. I was still in medical shock. I tried to kick my legs in the air. And it was at that point that I realized they were much lighter and blood was going everywhere. And that's when they started to strap down the lower half of my body. I know that they put tourniquets on. People were screaming. One man was above me telling me the helicopter's on its way. It's on its way, still smacking my face. And that's the first time I died. I died again in the life flight, and I died again on the surgery table at Bryan West Medical Center in Lincoln, Nebraska. As Dr. Reginald Burton and David Simani worked tirelessly into the morning to save my life. They didn't think that I was ever going to get to walk again.
Yeah. Wow.
So I've been through a lot on that end, and unlike a normal amputee, they couldn't just sew me up because I had gaping holes that you could reach in and touch my flesh and my bone and whatever else. So they used a product called A-cell stem cell on me, which is dried pig's bladder mixed with stem cells. And so every Tuesday and Friday for the better part of a year, I went into these debridement surgeries where they would debride off the necroted tissue and reapply this A-cell stem cell pattern tissue to regenerate muscle and skin and the growth there, which was great in concept until I believe that the product had gotten attached to my bone.
Yeah.
Because I became a very small portion of the entire worldwide amputee community who had to be re-amputated due to osteoregenesis, which is where the bone literally tries to regrow itself.
Oh, wow.
And so I was amputated again on Christmas Day of 2015. And, you know, I had tried getting up into my first set of prosthetics already, and that didn't happen. And so I got into a very depressed state of mind. I was on 22 different medications a day.
Wow.
Trying to cope with phantom pain, depression, everything. Everything had a new step. I didn't even know, you know, how to properly bathe myself. I didn't know anything about being in a wheelchair. Interestingly enough, you run into a lot of things when you start using a wheelchair. And so I gained a bunch of weight at one point. I think I weighed 150 pounds.
Wow. What would your normal fighting weight be?
My normal weight with legs was right around 100, 115, and my normal weight now is right around 70 to 80 pounds.
Oh, wow. So you picked up a lot.
A lot. Almost doubled my body weight. And I was not in a good place. I had to put myself into rehab for the first time to take myself off all of the narcotics that the doctors had me on to cope with all of this stuff. And it was in 2016, I made a decision to move to Colorado because they have medicinal and recreational marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And that really saved my life. I was able to take myself off all of the medications. I substituted that for one medication for all. And medicinal marijuana changed my life.
So just to pause this. So with the marijuana, was it a prescription that you were put onto, or were you just going to one of those new pharmacies on the street corner and buying your stash of gummy bears?
Oh, no. Actually, in Colorado, it is recreational and medicinal. I know that there's a lot of legislation here in America over the legalities of pot, and it's federally illegal, but in Colorado, it's recreational, meaning anybody can go on the street and buy it. I did start that way, but I proceeded to get my medical card and go into that route. It changed everything for me, and so I was able to lose all of that weight, and I began to, I guess, fall back into a pattern of feeling sorry for myself because I had, in my isolation out there in Colorado, picked up alcoholism pretty bad.
Mm. Yeah. What was your tipple of choice?
Anything with alcohol in it.
Yeah.
But definitely, you know, whiskey, vodkas, whatever. Anything. It was a microbrew capital of the United States, so it's a little difficult not to drink out there. It's a little difficult not to drink anywhere, but it's doable.
So how intense was your alcoholism? I mean, some people can drink after 5 every day, 7 days a week, and consider themselves alcoholics. Some people wake up and they pour themselves a drink, and it starts then and it finishes when you pass out.
When I was in the alcoholism grips pretty badly, I would wake up and drink. I knew that if I didn't have that glass of wine or that beer or that shot in the morning, that I was going to be shaking violently and not be able to work and do all of this stuff. It really took over.
Mm. So I want you to pause there just for a second for perspective. You get through the shock of losing your legs. You figure out how to become mobile in a wheelchair. You kind of figure out that life is becoming, I don't want to ever think normal, but somewhat better than it was. And your head's in a good space. This is going to sound like an absolutely callous question, but what at your core is causing you the depression? Is it the fact that you're now in society without legs and you're feeling inadequate? Is it because your life's dreams that you might have had prior to the train accident have now been shattered and all of those realizations are coming home to roost?
All of that. You know, throughout my entire life, I was very avid in the outdoors. And I grew up hunting and fishing and foraging and gardening. And I had just really looked at the situation, and I remember my parents had bought a gorilla cart.
What's that?
A gorilla cart. It's a gardening cart. The first year that I had been amputated, because one of our favorite things to do together was to mushroom hunt and forage for morels.
Right.
But I couldn't go walking, and I couldn't crawl yet. I hadn't discovered that part of myself. And they put the cart and, you know, drug me a mile through this cornfield to get me to the edge of where the morels usually came in our family spot. And it was very depressing, you know. How am I ever going to be a mother and teach my daughter how to walk or, you know, roller skate or dance? How am I going to do all of these things that I wanted to do? I wanted to hike up mountains. I wanted to train horses. I wanted to work in the kitchen as, you know, a full-time executive chef. Mm. And all of these things just seemed to completely shut off my identity almost.
Mm.
I didn't know, like, who I was, where I was, what I was going to do, what my purpose was. I had no idea. And I became even more depressed after my alcoholism had taken its grips in Colorado and the isolation. And, you know, on April 21st, the night before I did the incline, I came to a point where I was very suicidal.
Yeah.
I had provisions set for my dogs, and I went up to Eagle's Nest, which is a mountain outpass, with a loaded .45 and no intentions of going back down the mountain.
Oh, wow.
I had made a social post about a week before in 2018 asking people to do the incline with me because I was fed up and tired of feeling sorry for myself. I just needed somebody to believe in me, to believe that I could do it.
Yeah.
And everybody had bailed, or so I thought. And luckily, when I got up to that mountain pass, there was some black truck up there with a couple in it, obviously doing things that couples do in the mountain outlooks.
There we go. Yeah, yeah. Didn't playing banjos.
Yep. Didn't want to interrupt their evening. And so as I sat there, something had made me fall asleep. And I remember waking up the next morning and the sun was just cresting in through the mountain valley and Colorado Springs was below, and my phone went off, and it was an older gentleman named Keith that I had used to drink with at the bar, who had actually remembered that I wanted to go and do the incline, and said, "Hey, if you want to do that today, go and meet me over there." Get over there, and there's another random Instagrammer that had just went through my message requests, and I hadn't even talked to him before. And so we set off and we did the incline. I went down to the base of the mountain and had a few beers at my favorite little Manitou bar, and I went home and I went to sleep. I was just proud of myself for doing it. It wasn't that remarkable to me.
The perspective here is you climb the Manitou incline. I assume you started that morning sober, or because of your sobering night at the top, or had you had a shot or two and now you decide to go up the mountain, and you've got no legs at this point. You've got no wheelchair, so you go up on your hands, right?
Yeah. And I definitely drank that morning. I had not eaten. I remember that we didn't have food going up the incline the first time. And so I was hungover. It's a miracle that I made it up the first time, because you got to imagine that the Manitou incline isn't just a bunch of steps. It's 2,700 railroad ties that gain 2,000 feet of elevation in under a mile. Some of those ties are 2-3 foot tall.
Yeah.
It was a miracle that I did it without any issues.
So you get to the top and you've at that point you figure, oh well, this is nothing too big a deal. You're gonna go back down the mountain and have a drink.
Yeah, and that's what I did. I had a drink and I went home and I went to bed. I didn't even post the video until the next day. And that's when everything really blew up. The Manitou Incline I didn't realize how big of a staple it is in our community, because I had been so isolated there in Colorado. I didn't expect it to take off the way it did.
Yeah.
Within 24 hours, I had every news station in Colorado Springs and Denver contacting me. I had Yahoo, MSN, BBT, just every platform you can think of contacting me. And I had never been through anything quite like that.
So that means the sheer enormity of doing that on your hands that got everybody's attention, I suppose. It's sort of, to me, somewhat ironic that you get taken out by a train on train tracks, and that's essentially the end of who you used to be. And then you climb a ridge that is made up of railroad ties, and that kind of catapults you into a new place, a new me, the new you.
Yeah. It gave me a new purpose. I didn't realize how many people I could touch, how many people I could help. I've been through a lot, and I know that things get very dark. I've lost jobs. I've nearly starved. I've been very isolated. I've There's so many things that humanity that could connect upon if we just could remember to be a little kinder. We're still human, you know?
Well, isn't that so true? That's busy being played out in the streets of America at the moment. With a little bit of kindness, a whole lot of this stuff would go away. Yeah, very true. And so with all the media attention, where does that take you? Because you don't strike me as being the sort of person that would seek out, overtly anyway, publicity.
No, it just came to me, and that's kind of how it has been. I kind of set out on a journey, so to say, to help as many people as I could. And so I got charities involved and decided to go and climb Pike's Peak in their name to raise money for them, because it gave me purpose to help other people. I may have been the one that was on the ground crawling and hurting and whatever else, but it gave me purpose to know that this is going to help out some veterans that we have. This is going to help out our community. This is going to touch other people. And then there's the other amputees that contact me, asking me for advice, asking me advice for their children too, that I didn't know about. It's the people who were suicidal themselves that reached out to me and said, I had a gun to my head, but I stopped because I saw your story.
Yeah.
I've gotten a lot of that. And all I want to do is tell people that no matter what you go through, life goes on. You don't have to get so hung up on that one little thing. You know, I went and did the mountain, and Daniel Pond, the mountaineer who had coached me up to Pike's Peak and doing that. And I did this just a month after doing the incline. No training, still an alcoholic. He had to go hang a bear bag of wine so that I didn't go into withdrawals.
Stop there for a second, because a lot of my listeners are from Africa and they don't know what a bear bag is. You'd have to explain.
A bear bag is a waterproof, tight sealed bag that you throw up into the trees, the pine trees, so that the bears don't get it. It's okay. Generally used for food stashes or extra water stashes, but in this case, the one bear bag that needed to be hung was full of wine so that I didn't go into withdrawals.
Oh, wow. So the perspective is you're going up a 14,100 and something odd foot mountain, and instead of taking crystal clear stream water with you, you're stashing some wine to feed the habit. I mean, that in itself is, to climb a mountain drunk, and particularly a high altitude mountain, that's an achievement. And then you do it on your hands. That's an even bigger achievement. How long did it take you?
It was a 3-day excursion.
Yeah.
We had camped at Bar Camp and up at the A-frame, which is a little lean-to on the edge of the edge of the tree line to give people a little shelter from lightning and other such storms that roll through. So,
and temperature?
It was very cold up there. It gets very cold up at elevation.
So
with
you
help, but
what about the equipment? Did you have a crew of people that walked with you and took up tents and sleeping bags and
I did
anything
not.
Else?
That random Instagrammer that had messaged me and asked me if I still wanted to do the incline. He actually was a mountaineer who does veteran excursions for other programs and communities. And he just said, hey, if you want to go up the mountain, I'll go with you. I'll carry the stuff. And so it was just me and one other. And we set off from the base of the incline even.
Hmm.
There's two options. When you go to climb Pikes Peak, there's two options. You can take Bar Trail all the way up, or you can start at the base of the incline and go all the way up. And we started at the base of the incline.
So, you go up the incline, you reach a point three quarters of the way up where you can branch off and do the Bar Trail.
Yes.
Okay, got it. Yep. So you repeated those railway ties.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. I'm seriously impressed. And now the guy who's climbing with you, he's able-bodied, got all of his everything intact, and he's just there as a moral support.
As well, so.
And at no point he picks you up. He just walks with you, encourages you, feeds you wine.
Yeah. There was only one point in that entire excursion that he had carried me, and that was from the tent to the bathroom at Bar Camp in the morning. To go. So,
I mean, if that in its own is not inspirational, I don't know what can be. How did your hands look at the end of 3 days of using them as feet?
On the first excursion, this one with Daniel Pond, it was terrible. Yeah. My knuckles were bloody. The entire palm of my hand here was a blister. This was an entire blister. In between my fingers were blistered and bloody.
Yeah.
It was bad. I didn't have much for scrapes or bruises anywhere else, but I did learned that rock on your bottom for 3 days, tends to leave some bruising. So I had a bruised tailbone.
Yeah.
Other than that, though, I made it up safely.
And again, elation when you got to the top, or was it were you just sort of in a drunken stupor and didn't really care for the fact that you were there?
Oh, definitely wasn't in a drunken stupor. I was incredibly ecstatic to be up there.
Yeah.
My family had met me at the top. They had flown from Missouri into Colorado to see me and make sure that I made it up the mountain safely. And so that was a nice moment to share with them.
Do you feel that once you had summited that your life was starting to turn around and things were looking up and up and getting better?
To an extent, I was struggling a lot with the alcoholism, and I struggled a lot with the media contacting me, all of these thousands and thousands of people contacting me, telling me that I'm a hero. But I personally, I couldn't even get out of bed without taking a shot. What kind of hero is that? It was a struggle internally for me because I felt as though I was lying to people, but I was also just trying to be myself through the alcoholism, and that doesn't ever work. And I had drank so much that I didn't care about what I had done or the actions that I had made. I ended up getting DUI after DUI in a short span of time.
Hold on a second there. There's just something that I pick on. You've got no legs. So you get three DUIs. Are you driving your wheelchair at speed through overcrowded streets, or have you got a specially modified motor vehicle?
I had a specially modified motor vehicle at the time. I had since sold it, but yes. Yeah. At the time. It had hand controls in it, and I abused that privilege. I was not in any shape to be driving in any of those scenarios, and it came to a head. I had also lost both of my grandparents, and the 2 weeks prior to my third arrest. And on my third arrest, it was another very violent suicidal situation that wasn't good. I had evidently hurt an EMT in that process, and I woke up in jail. I had to spend 3 days in CJC, which is the correctional facility there in Colorado Springs. I was not on a bond. They gave me a no bond hold.
Yeah.
They put me in isolation because I was recognizable and people in the jail would know me.
Yeah.
So
were they worried about you getting abused, beaten up in jail, or what was the reason for the isolation? Oh, wow.
Yeah, that, and so.
How long were you in isolation?
The entire time I was there.
Oh.
They kept me in an individual cell. And I was allowed 1 hour out on the block, but a couple of the inmates had told me through the doors to go and talk to this lady at a table. And so I went to go and talk to her, and she was the bond, investigator who would set it up with the judge to see if he would allow for a bond.
So she's not an inmate. She's from the outside.
Yes. Yes.
So you're in one of those like meeting rooms where you handcuffed the table or something. Was it a little bit freer than that?
A little bit freer than that. She had just finished her rounds with the other inmates because they had let me out and I was isolated. Yeah. And so I had gotten to talk to her, and she put me up. She gave me the opportunity to get up in front of the judge and ask for a bond. And so that Tuesday morning, I had gotten in front of the judge on the screen, and I won't ever forget what he had said to me. He looked at my paperwork and he looked up at the screen and he goes, "You know, Miss Horvath, to be quite honest with you, I don't want to let you out." He goes,
"That must have shattered you, eh?"
It did. It did. But he said something next that also made me. He said, "Miss Horvath, if you're going to kill yourself with your drinking, don't take anybody else out with you." And he said, "I'm going to give you this one opportunity to make things right." And he let me out on a personal recognizance bond.
What is that? Can you elaborate a little?
A personal recognizance bond is essentially where you are only fined a small amount, but you are personally responsible for making sure that you are following all of the guidelines that are given to you. One of my guidelines, for instance, was sobriety monitoring. And so I had to call a phone line every day to see if I would have to go test and provide them urine for alcohol evaluation. And in the event where I were to come up dirty or anything like that, if I were to leave the state, if I were to do anything that involves more police contact, my personal recognizance bond would be stripped from me and I would be back in jail on a no bond hold, meaning that I wouldn't be able to proceed with any of my daily life in between my sentencing. And so he gave me this ability to go out and continue to work and get myself sober outside of jail. This is essentially what he did. And directly after getting out of jail, I went over to the alcohol evaluation intake center to go ahead and get registered on that and whatever else. And mind you, I had been in jail for 3 days.
Yeah.
I had been withdrawing really, really badly. I had no medical attention. And as I said, I was in isolation. And so I had gotten the evaluation done, obviously came back clean, whatever else. And as I was getting ready to go back to my home, I had gotten a call from one of the Gazette's writers here in Colorado, there in Colorado Springs.
That's a local newspaper?
It's a newspaper. It's the Colorado Springs newspaper.
Yeah.
And he had very quickly instructed me not to answer my phone, not to log into my Facebook, to deactivate it, actually, to take down my Instagram, to go ahead and take Snapchat off of my phone, and all of this other stuff. I had no idea what was about to happen. But as it turns out, another news station there in Colorado Springs had gotten wind of my arrest and decided to post it up through the media for the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
That the woman who climbed Pike's Peak without legs is in jail on battery charges and DUI.
Why were they wanting to do that to you? Just because? Sell a paper?
You know, all of these media affiliates there in Colorado Springs, the Gazette, KKTV, all of the other ones had contacted me, warning me prior, back whenever I had first done the incline. A reporter from one of the stations there in Colorado Springs had contacted me and said that he passed my story along so that he could take me out on a date. Pause for just a moment.
Sure. Well, that squeaking that you've been hearing in the background is Mandy's dog. She's just spun around in her wheelchair and very nimbly headed off to the door to let the dog out. I'm glad in a way that she's done this right now, because it's giving me a moment to pause and think about everything that she said to me. You'll have noticed some pregnant pauses in my conversation. I've been fairly shattered at everything she's had to say.
Okay. So
he had to recap, passed your name along so that he could get a date with you.
Yeah. And so I had taken this reporter to one of my very first stand-up comedian little open mic things. And I had several friends there, which he decided to disrespect and be rude to. After that night, he had come back to me and apologized and whatever else for his actions and treating people the way that he had that night. And so I said that was fine, whatever else. But then it was about 2 weeks prior to my arrest that he messaged me and he said, I would like to come over and make you feel good before you go to bed. And I responded, no, thank you. That's not the kind of woman I am.
Okay.
And then it wasn't too long after that I had gotten a text message that had said, I heard all of the shit you talked on me, and you best believe if anybody asks, they'll find out what I think of you.
Oh, wow.
It was his news station that decided to post this up first, putting my life's biggest accomplishment next to my life's biggest failure. So it was at that point I learned that being in media as a woman is incredibly difficult.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that is just so mean. It's hard to hear. You take somebody when they're down and you make sure they get knocked down even further. That's just, that's sick.
It's really okay, though. I think I've done some pretty incredible things with it. It really, pardon my French, it destroyed me.
Yeah.
Within a matter of a couple hours of getting that phone call from the Gazette and him warning me that this was already out and being pushed by him and his colleagues, that you know, my face was on Snapchat stories next to Kylie Jenner's ass. Like my mugshot was in the paper.
Yeah. You shared that mugshot. Well, not, I don't know if it was the mugshot, but you showed on your Instagram account where you had been and why you had been there. And if I remember, there was a picture of you either after you were arrested or while you were being arrested before you went into jail.
Yes, sir.
It wasn't such a pretty picture.
Nope. Yeah. It is not a pretty picture.
So now you've come out of jail and you've been given this wonderful second chance. And that's when you find out that you've been kicked in the teeth by this guy.
Yeah.
So it kind of must want you to just head straight back to the bottle store and get another short of whiskey or so. No?
No. That wasn't an option at that point. You know, I had hundreds of thousands of people online commenting that I would never stay sober, that I was just a piece of trash, that I deserved to be hit by a train, that I deserved the life that I lived. It changed me.
Mm.
It made me realize how cruel humanity can be. On the other token, it fueled me to stay sober.
So out of the adversity, you found the opportunity just to screw everybody else and say, fuck you all.
Yeah, pretty much.
Awesome. Excuse my French, but that's kind of the way it has to be, right?
Yeah. And so I got sober. I put myself in rehab again, this time to relieve myself of alcoholism. And I did over 300 hours of community service. I spent the entire last summer in jail.
Wait, stop. Say that again.
This yeah.
Entire last summer in jail. Is that part of your DUI penalty or?
Yes. I was convicted and got up to speak my piece with the judge in April of 2019. And he had sentenced me to 120 days in El Paso County Work Release Program.
Yeah.
And so I spent from April to August in jail. I finished my college finals with an Expo marker. I stayed working.
That's cool.
Stayed on my stuff. And as a result, I was able to plan an expedition from within jail.
Wow.
And
where was that expedition going to be to?
This expedition was going to be for myself and another legless veteran up Pikes Peak.
Again.
Because it wasn't enough the first time.
Exactly. You're a sucker for punishment.
I had inspired Travis to do the incline, and I know that he really liked doing that and being to help the other veterans and such. And so
mm-hmm.
we had set out on this mission to go ahead and climb Pikes Peak together just to show that it can be done.
God, showing them once wasn't enough, right? Yeah, that he can do it now too. Wow. And you do this while you're sitting in jail amidst a bunch of other people who've sort of taken the wrong turn in life.
There's all kinds of turns. Mm. And the cool thing about a wrong turn is sometimes it leads to cool destinations.
Yeah.
Most generally, you can turn right back around.
I like that. That's very nice. Yeah, you can. You've got to have some serious willpower to do that, though, when you've been so far down, to get back up and go for it.
Yeah.
That's a lot of strength.
You know, I remember 5 years ago, whenever I was in the hospital, there was a preacher that would come to my room almost every day, and he helped my family and I out a lot. And one of the biggest things that he wanted to press to me is, I just had a little faith, I could move mountains.
Mm-hmm. Rising
less grain.
Yeah. Now, faith in who? Faith in yourself, or faith in the greater being?
The faith in a greater being and faith in myself. I had absolutely no faith in anything after I had lost my limbs. I didn't think that there would be a life after limb loss.
Yeah, it's not something that somebody gets to think about. I suppose we all are just very grateful to have what we have and don't ever consider what it would be like if we didn't have what we have.
Yeah.
So this minister comes into your life, and that was at what point? I missed that.
He was there from the beginning of me losing my limbs. He was one of the first preachers that was in my hospital room.
Excuse me.
I guess my point in telling you that was 5 years ago, I didn't think that I would ever climb a mountain, much less have faith in myself to take somebody up.
Yeah, so that's, you're now the guide. You've gone from being unable to the enabler. That's incredible. That's a wonderful transition.
It's definitely rewarding. The people that I want to reach are the ones that actually need the help. And those are the ones that most often don't reach out to anybody. They listen to podcasts like this, or, you know, there's always help out there. For as many evil and nasty people out there, there's a nice one right behind them. There's people you can trust. And the biggest thing from that is to trust yourself, because no one can do things the way that you know that you can do. If that makes any sense.
No, it totally does. And I think for a lot of people, it takes some form of awakening to realize what their potential is. I think so many of us move through life doing what we do because we can, and we don't really challenge ourselves to go beyond what we know because we're fearful of the outcome, or we're fearful of failing. What's obvious to me in your story is you haven't failed for any fault of your own. And you've taken adversity and you've risen up above it. It sounds like you've needed to settle a few things along the way. But I mean, how do you come to terms without your legs when you've had dreams and aspirations of a life that you now kind of feel that you could never live again? And yeah, it takes some support to get beyond that point. And, you know, Mandy, that's where your story for me is really so inspirational, because all of a sudden what seemed like something, let's say a life that was going to be impossible, you're turning around and you actually not just dreaming of things that can be made possible, you're doing it. And that is absolutely phenomenal. For a lot of people, hiking up with both limbs to a 14,000 foot mountain would be a lifetime goal. It would be one of their biggest physical achievements ever. And then you go and do it without even really thinking about it, on your hands, bruising your butt along the way up. It just shows us that if we've got strength of mind and strength of will, our chassis that carries us around can be trained to do anything. We just need to condition our mind to do it. And I think you're just a beautiful illustration of that very, very point. Kind of feel as though we've got to a point in your life now that brings us up to today, where you've moved from Colorado to the sweaty end of America, which is Florida. What are you doing down there?
In November, Steve Chamberlain of 50 Legs Organization came out to Colorado to meet me in my little shoebox apartment, and looked down at me. He's this big 6 foot tall dude, you know, he's looking down at me in my chair with his one prosthetic leg, and he goes, we're gonna get you up and walking, like, for real this time.
Yeah.
Like, no pain. I promise they'll be custom fit. And if you want to continue to walk for the rest of your life, you can. You just got to come down here to Florida and meet these people at POA, Prosthetics and Orthotics Association, there in Florida. And so he was there on September 28th, and by November 4th, I was on a plane down to Florida, and so I got fitted up.
I was just saying, that's when we could fly, yeah.
Yeah. And I got fitted up. I got walking really well. I was completely ambulatory without using my wheelchair for much of anything. And then the COVID happened. So naturally, whenever an amputee uses prosthetic limbs, especially for an above knee, we tend to shrink. Our natural limb volume that goes into the socket shrinks. And it makes it so the socket eventually does not fit anymore, and you need
a
new set of sockets. And so that's where I'm at right now. I've shrunken out of my first set of sockets, which is really good, actually, except, you know, then there was COVID. So I'm getting back in and getting fitted for another set of sockets so that I can get back into the ambulatory walking. And from there, we'll be getting a DEX scan so that I can start running. That'll be cool.
Just by the way, so I've got a few questions about these prosthetics. What's a DEX scan?
A DEX scan is a scan that determines your bone density. What we want to check for is, because I was having issues with osseoregeneration in the past and they had to re-amputate, they want to make sure that the heterotrophic bone that forms at the end of my residual limb on the above knee is going to be stable enough for the impact of running. Okay. And so what they'll do is they'll go in for the scan, they'll check the bone density and make sure that that heterotrophic bone is where it needs to be in its strength.
Okay, understood. And now these legs themselves, are they like fully mechanized in so much as your ankle can move like an ankle joint and your knee can move like a knee joint?
Absolutely. I have what they call the plie threes of the Ottobock version. And you can find this kind of online if you want to do a little more in-depth research on the Ottobock website. But essentially, my knees are microprocessor ran. I have to plug them in every night. I can connect them to my phone for different modes and stances.
This is fascinating. Practically, how would you use your phone and your knee at the same time? I'm just trying to visualize how this happens.
Absolutely. So through the Ottobock syncing app with your legs, my legs, excuse me. This is a little out there for the general person, but they're Bluetooth capable. And so they connect through the Bluetooth, and I can put like a stance in there for driving. And what it does is it locks up the knee mechanism so that I'm not having a bending knee whenever I lift my leg. Gotcha. And I can actually press on the gas pedal or the brake. They have other modes in there, like a locking mode if you're just standing and you don't really want to have to focus. There's all kinds of stuff that you can do with them, really, and I haven't even gotten too far into it. I was just ecstatic to be up and walking in general, in day-to-day life. It's kind of like walking with two robotic stilts that you kind of just have to trust. But these microprocessor knees are constantly adjusting on my behalf, and my ankles allow for a lot of flexion, and it's made a lot of difference there as well. I also have a rotator knee joint that helps me to get dressed and such.
Wow.
So, because if you think about it, if you've ever dressed like a doll, their knees don't bend.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult to get a pair of pants onto a pair of knees that don't bend.
Right.
And so I'm able to just flip that knee and actually put my clothes on that way.
Wow. It's,
yeah.
That's, I mean, technology is awesome. That's phenomenal stuff. And then I suppose in a couple of years' time, as this artificial intelligence thing moves along its way, you'll probably be able to have a chip inserted inside your brain where if you think move leg, it'll talk to the knee joint or the ankle joint.
Well, one of the great things about being in college is I've actually done quite a bit of research on that because I was curious myself. And brain-computer interface technology is actually becoming very prevalent in the AI world.
Mm-hmm.
What they're doing is they're testing on monkeys and such right now to get different neurosynapsis cues, so to say. And those cues are what moves the robotics. So what they have now is they have monkeys that can think to reach for a banana and the robotic will do it on their behalf. And so that is already on its way. I'm not sure that I would be comfortable with that because along with brain computer interface technology, you're giving essentially a computer your entire thought process, how you think, your emotions and how those affect your actions. And I'm personally a little anti-technology, so I wouldn't get the chip, but I do know that brain computer interface technology is headed in that direction so that eventually we will have amputees that can just think to move their limbs.
That's crazy. I lost you there, but that's really crazy.
It's already on its way.
Wow. I remember when I was a youngster at school, we had a fellow who came, this is back in South Africa, by the way, who came out to study, and he was from the United Kingdom. His name was Rupert. I forget his last name. And he had a prosthetic foot. And being boys, we'd play soccer and stuff out in the playgrounds. And it was always a riot and quite hilarious when he kicked the ball and the ball went one way and his foot would come off and go the other way. It was very rudimentary stuff back then. And it's amazing what technology is allowed to happen today. So in your studies, what are you studying? Where do you see yourself going with once you've completed that degree? What is it going to be in?
I am studying for communications is what I'm studying in college right now. It encompasses anything from web design development to marketing and advertising and basically anything to do with media.
Funny, hey, that one industry that came to haunt you, you're now going back into that in a stronger way, stronger position.
Yeah, I want to study rhetoric quite a bit more and get some writing out.
Well, you've got an incredible story. Hopefully you can write that down and share it with the world. I did read somewhere a wonderful line, and it relates to a mountain peak that is 19,341 feet above sea level. And I understand that that's going to have your name on top of it sometime soon. I'm hoping you know which mountain I'm talking about.
You must be talking about Kilimanjaro.
There we go.
I would love to go out there and climb that. It's a life dream of mine. I'll get there eventually.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm obviously, you can tell I'm an African. I'm in the African travel industry and in fact, the company that's going to be sponsoring this podcast is Alluring Africa. It's a friend of mine. He's over in Winter Park in Florida. He's a Kenyan, and he runs this wonderful tour operation. I think he doesn't know that I'm interviewing you, and he doesn't know that you have ambitions to climb Kilimanjaro. But I'm pretty sure that between the two of us, we can help you get there. We can also help you go on a little bit of a safari afterwards, because after you've climbed 19,000 feet on your feet, you need to go and put them up and relax and enjoy some wildlife that roam the plains of the Serengeti and the Tarangire. How does that resonate?
That sounds amazing.
Well, Mandy, I think we're going to stay in touch once this COVID quandary has passed us by and we figured out how to live with it. It'd be a pleasure to try and help you to get up Kilimanjaro. I've never climbed it. Friends of mine have. It's a beautiful mountain. It really is, and it's a volcanic peak. It's really gorgeous.
I've only seen pictures. I'm ready to see it in person. So.
Wow. Awesome. Hey, listen, I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation with you. Normally, under normal circumstances and conditions, my podcasts are sit around a campfire and we tell stories like we do in Africa about lions and leopards and elephants and things. So you've helped me to shift out of my comfort zone and tackle a subject that I wasn't too sure I was capable of doing. But I think you tell your story really, really beautifully. And yeah, thanks so much. Keep doing what you're doing. I think you continue to inspire people and yeah, keep it going.
Thank you for having me. Please share those links with me so that I can get them shared on my page as well.
Yeah, Mandy, I will do. Thank you.
Hey. All right. Thank you.
Bye.